Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who has been playing a very important role in our time's phase of that long-running war, well, an endless war, one might call it, is our first guest. Her name is Dr. Victoria Coates. She has served with distinction in a variety of government posts, including as National Security Advisor to Senator Ted Cruz and as the Deputy National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump. These days, she is heading up the new Mideast and North Africa program of the Center for Security Policy, and I couldn't be more delighted about that. She's also a senior fellow of the center. Victoria Coates, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
I've got a lot of things I want to talk to you about, but let's start with topic A for most of us, I guess, at the moment now. You've written a very thoughtful piece yesterday at National Review entitled simply, After Afghanistan. Tell us about the lessons that you think we should have learned from this disaster at the hands of the Biden team, and whether there's a chance that we actually will learn such lessons.
Well, again, thank you for having me on. Obviously, this is a very difficult topic, and you know, the thing that's most disheartening to me is in Washington this week, meeting with some of our partners and allies across the region, they're all just in a state of shocked disbelief. They don't understand what has happened. They don't understand what the United States is doing. And I think, as I'm sure we'll discuss, this is going to lead to some interesting decision making over coming weeks and months.
Interesting being an interesting choice of words. Portentous, yeah. Comes to mind as well.
Yeah. Indeed. In terms of the National Review piece, there were just two main points I wanted to make, and they're quite simple, but I think they should be self-evident, but they're not. And one is no more nation building. As you look at what we did, the extraordinary investment in Afghanistan, and I understand why we did a lot of these things. They're desirable. You see the students from the American University in Afghanistan, for example, all of these sort of civil society projects that we poured time, treasure, and even blood into, everyone wants, and many Afghans want, you know, better education. They want, you know, a good legal system, all of these things. But those aren't in many ways ours to give. And our philosophy of foreign assistance has, from the early 60s, from some of the beginnings of the big foreign assistance programs, been driven by the notion that we have to give this aid in a disinterested way. You know, we don't label it as coming from America. We don't put conditions on it, and the theory behind that is if you don't do that, it won't be accepted, or it won't seem authentic, and that has just dragged us into this swamp where we have to do everything, and we wind up doing nothing. So, point one: no more nation building. It's basically a call for a complete revamping of how we give assistance. Number two is the enemy of my enemy is not my friend when he is a terrorist. And again, this should be self-evident, but we are seeing the administration charge towards recognition of the Taliban, cooperation with the Taliban, aid to the Taliban. Suddenly, they're not your father's Taliban, they're nice Taliban. No, they're not. And you know, the notion that we can find common cause with them is just delusional. And it really took me back to Iraq in the 2014-15 timeframe, when the Obama administration made common cause with the Iranian proxies, the Popular Mobilization Forces, or PMF, to try to fight ISIS.
And those being Iranian operations through and through.
And we wound up basically, you know, paying the salaries of the Iranian terrorist proxies, and it's turned into a massive, horrible problem. And I just would really prefer we don't do that again in Afghanistan.
You know, Victoria, part of, it seems to me, the problem with both of those lessons being understood initially in the event, let alone now, is a failure to really comprehend what we are contending with in what I call Sharia supremacism. There are other ways to describe it, but that seems to me to be particularly apt. I think Eddie McCarthy first coined it. But the point is that if you don't recognize that a society dominated by this oppressive doctrine of Sharia and supremacist doctrine at that, let alone that it is impelling people who may have their differences on points of theology or simply, you know, their ambitions to be the dominant force, nonetheless share this jihadist doctrine and all that flows from it, you're going to get this wrong every time. And, you know, when we help draft a Sharia supremacist or Sharia compliant, at least, constitution for Afghanistan, that was kind of a fatal problem, it seems, in terms of the whole nation-building enterprise. It certainly has colored our thinking about, as you've said, these two prime examples of the thought that, well, some Sharia supremacists are good and people we can work with, and some are not. And if we can work with the first against the second, then all will be well. Not bloody likely. So anyway, I think these are really two tremendously important insights, and I do hope that we'll take away from them the apt lessons you've recommended. Let me just ask you about this issue of kibono, I guess is the way the Romans would say it. One of the parties that has emerged as a prime beneficiary of this defeat of the United States, engineered by Joe Biden and company, is the Chinese Communist Party. Talk a little bit about how you see that playing out in this environment. You argue in the piece that because of these difficult residual terrorist elements that we'll face in Afghanistan, our mission there is actually not going to end. How does it get performed, though, if the Chinese wind up turning this into kind of a protectorate for the Taliban under their, you know, sort of military, political, diplomatic authority?
Well, it's going to be very interesting to watch. The People's Republic of China, the PRC, is certainly going to try. You know, Afghanistan is obviously right up against China, and there is, I think, well-placed concern that the Taliban may be more interested in the Muslim elements in Western China, you know, such as the Uyghurs. And it could cause potentially some instability for China. I mean, that's something China won't tolerate. So I think they are going to be absolutely interested in some sort of hegemony over Afghanistan. And then there's the issue of the natural resources. And, you know, a lot of people are asking what President Trump might or might not have done in the first 7 or 8 months of his second term had he had one. One thing I think for sure he would have focused on was those natural resources. If we've poured trillions of dollars into Afghanistan, at the very least, you know, U.S. private industry should be the ones to develop it. And I think he would have understood that strategic resource very clearly. And China does as well. So I think for China, both the potential instability domestically and the potential resources are going to make Afghanistan a strong target. And if they're entrenched there and somehow, you know, come to some sort of devil's bargain with the Taliban, they'll probably be less finicky about it than I might be. That we will have a lot of trouble controlling terrorism coming out of there.
Yeah, as long as it's aimed at us, not at China. This brings me to another piece of the interesting repercussions of all of this, Victoria Coates, and that is, if the Taliban has its way, armed as it is now to the teeth with advanced weaponry, left behind by the United States. There are some who believe they will turn their attentions to trying to extend their version of Sharia emirates into neighboring Pakistan at the expense of their former sponsors there. Or maybe their continuing sponsors there, the Pakistani government, for the purpose, among other things, of liberating some, if not all, of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. Do you see that as a real danger coming out of all of this?
Well, Pakistan's status as a nuclear state has, you know, long been kind of the elephant in the room with national security issues. People don't talk about it a great deal. It's a huge potential problem for the region and beyond. And, you know, obviously we know, all know that Pakistan has been engaged in various degrees of proliferation. And certainly, you know, that relationship between the Taliban and Pakistan could go in a couple different directions. I mean, if they remain close collaborators, you know, there can be a universe in which Pakistan decides it's going to share some of its arsenal. And if it turns adversarial, as you suggest, and, you know, I'm in the school where you never assume these people won't collaborate and you never assume they won't turn on each other because they're perfectly capable of both. You know, it is possible if the Taliban manage to entrench themselves, you know, and you know, start to become sort of a going concern, you know, they could turn on Pakistan. And what does that look like? It certainly doesn't look pretty.
It does not, and may prove mortally dangerous to boot. Let me ask you about the other nuclear jihadist enterprise, namely the mullahocracy of Iran. Victoria Coates, you've spent much of your professional life, I know, worrying about and trying with your various bosses to counter the threat from that quarter. We haven't talked in some weeks. I believe about the time we last did, there were some people opining that the nuclear breakout that has long been feared from Iran might be 10 weeks away. Well, if that's so, then maybe it's 5 or 6 weeks away now. Do you think that's realistic and accurate assessment? And if so, what did Joe Biden and Naftali Bennett of Israel talk about last week in this regard? And where do you think things stand with respect to the oft-stated commitment of both the U.S. and Israeli governments that Iran will not be allowed to get a nuclear weapon?
Well, I'm afraid, at least for the U.S. government, that statement rings pretty hollow at this point, because, you know, the United States has demonstrated that our statements and promises have very little value to them. And I, you know, I get a little bit less worried and tied up about timelines than some, because it's my view that once North Korea tested a small scale nuclear weapon 4 years ago, it doesn't matter, because the Iranians could buy the weapon. You know, they could buy it from the PACs. They could buy it from the North Koreans. We know they've tried in the past. So, you know, would they like to develop the domestic capability to produce their own weapons? Sure. But if they decide, you know, at whatever given moment that it's in their best interest to acquire and test a nuclear weapon, that could happen tomorrow. I mean, it could happen this afternoon.
If it hasn't happened already, then there are some who think that it probably has.
Right. And you know, again,
not the testing part necessarily, at least they're in their own right, but, you know, the acquisition.
And I think that's another very dangerous, unforeseen consequence of Afghanistan. I mean, do they look at this? Do they see the United States in retreat and disarray? Do they see the Taliban, you know, triumphant? And do they say, well, we, you know, this is our moment? Because they know the reason everyone treats Pakistan and North Korea with kid gloves is because they have nuclear weapons. So is this their moment to say, and they see them not paying any particular consequences at, say, the United Nations or anything like that. So, you know, did they say this is our moment? We're going to just
Victoria, this again, the policies of the Biden administration, quite apart from discrediting our word or our policy commitments through the Afghan debacle, has also been, of course, signaling to the Iranians that they can have their way with us because the Biden team is determined to try to negotiate some sort of new deal with them and lift sanctions and otherwise get back into business. So for all these reasons, it seems to me you're absolutely right. The Iranians almost certainly are going for it one way or the other. Which brings me back to Naftali Bennett and the Israelis. What is your current thinking about whether they will take matters into their own hands? And is there any evidence that that was telegraphed to Biden? So how did he respond?
I certainly wasn't ready to the meeting, so I wouldn't want to claim to have any particular insights into what they discussed. My outside view is that, you know, Bennett signaled that he would not be critical of the United States returning to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal, which is a very difficult issue for him domestically, because the JCPOA pulls like poison in Israel. So that,
across the political spectrum, as far as I can tell, right?
Well, I mean, it's a self-preservation issue. It's pretty straightforward. And I think, you know, that puts him in a very sensitive position because, you know, for Israel, the JCPOA is basically an existential threat. And, you know, to say, well, you can't criticize it if we do this. I mean, and it's also kind of a weird demand to make. It's one of the reasons I don't really understand how these folks make policy, you know, to tell an ally, well, you can't criticize us.
We're doing something that poses an existential threat to you and your people.
Precisely.
We're almost out of time, Victoria. Do you think that the quid pro quo there was that Biden told him, well, if you have to do something about this because it does pose an existential threat to you, we will, you know, not intervene or interpose, you know, military or other obstacles?
It's possible. I mean, my assumption is they would say you can't have any fingerprints on it. You have to make very clear we had nothing to do with it. You know, this sort of plausible deniability defense. But it, as I said, it's very hard for me to see how this turns out in any way well. And, you know, rather than worry about offending the Iranians, I think they would be better spending their time trying to support and bolster the Israelis.
I pray that's the upshot of all of this. I think it unlikely, unfrankly. But you'll be watching it closely, I know, at the Center for Security Policy, as will we here at Secure Freedom Radio. And we look forward to further visits with you about this and all the other issues we've been discussing and that are in your enormous portfolio in the Middle East and North Africa program of the Center for Security Policy. Victoria Coates, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your past service to our country, and keep up the great work. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with J.R. Nyquist about some insights about what actually was going on the ground in Afghanistan in this so-called success, enormous success, that of the Biden administration. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Biden administration insists that its end to the Afghan war was an enormous success. To paraphrase Bill Clinton, that depends on what the definition of success is. Taking nothing away from the brave Americans who extracted some 120,000 people from the jaws of the Taliban's killing machine, whether the evacuation was a success will depend in part on whether that number includes jihadists who are being admitted without vetting into this country and maybe, perhaps literally, ticking time bombs. The fact that the Biden team is trying to gaslight us into believing a rout was actually a great accomplishment not only further undermines confidence in its leadership and agenda. This stunning misrepresentation also puts into sharp relief and discredits what actually constitute other big lies perpetrated by Mr. Biden and his political and media allies over the past year. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say we are joined by one of the smartest guys I know, a wonderful contributor to this program. We've not talked with him as frequently as we need to, and we will be doing more of it, I hope, in the days ahead. His name is J.R. Nyquist. These days, he is writing often for the Epoch Times. You can also follow his work at jrnyquist.blog and check out some of his longer works, The Origins of the Fourth World War, and most recently, The Fool and His Enemy. It's always good to visit with him, and I'm pleased that we're going to do so now. J.R. Nyquist, welcome back. It's good to have you, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
You had on your blog the other day a very interesting and very provocative piece, and I wanted to discuss it with you a little bit, namely a report that you'd received from, I gather, an anonymous intelligence veteran, and I don't know whether he's anonymous to you or he's just an individual whose identity you're protecting, but talk a bit about what he is disclosing on the basis of, I gather, on the ground, on site, you know, inspection of the unraveling of our position in Afghanistan and some of its more ominous overtones.
Yeah, well, this intelligence veteran, he was intimately involved with the movement of people, this airlift, and he and the people around him, and I do know his identity, they do not understand this claim of 123,000 rescued in the airlift. Their number, as the best they can calculate it, is maybe a little bit over 30,000. So there's a 90,000 gap between what they see the administration is claiming, as Biden claimed in his speech on Monday, and what they see as possible. And this is quite alarming because they see that the administration plans to take in, you know, are they going to, the big question is, are they going to take in 90,000 people from somewhere and say they're Afghan refugees? What is the purpose of exaggerating these numbers and setting up a system for taking in that many people?
Honestly, I've been very concerned, I've talked about it in my commentary today, Jeff, about some of the people that they ostensibly have been pulling in from Afghanistan, who we have reason to believe have not been vetted properly and are almost certainly not deserving of the opportunity to move into the United States and maybe coming here with malign intent. I mean, a sort of Sharia supremacist, jihadist, you know, ambition to unleash mayhem, perhaps, in our country. That might be true of this particular population or some small subset of it, maybe, at least. But it also could be true of 90,000 people drawn from heavens knows where all else, if that were, in fact, the agenda.
Well, this intelligence veteran, he gave me information a few nights ago. Last night, he gave me more. There's more coming. And what he said last night was that the screening process of the people that got on those planes, he said planes were leaving empty. Planes were leaving partially full. And I know this, I talked to him near the beginning of the operation, and he was extremely frustrated because the first plane they sent, you know, nobody was getting through at the airport because of the foul-ups and because the Taliban was interfering with people reaching the plane. So the idea that these planes came in and were fully loaded is just simply not true. I mean, sometimes they were, but there was a lot of this going on. And the screening process, by the way, was quite intensive. They weren't supposed to be letting people like that through, you know. And so and the thing is that this list, one of the things is that he is certain that the list of the people that got through and the list of the people they're going to present to us is going to end up classified. He's quite certain about that. Now, that's interesting. Let's watch and see if we get access to that list, if we can see who's actually come into the country when finally these 90,000 people that are the difference between the 30,000 that they believe they processed and to make up the 123,000 that the administration claims they got out. Let's see if those numbers are public. Let's see if we can actually see who these people are.
And where they've gone, among other things. Jeff, let me just read a paragraph from this report that you've posted on your website, jrnyquist.blog, because it's stunning. And I'd like to ask you to amplify on it. He said in part, quote, "In fact, virtually everything you are hearing about Afghanistan from government sources is a fabrication. And even partisan opponents of the current administration are missing the mark. What we are seeing is not, quote, chaos, unquote, or, quote, incompetence, unquote. Rather, it has all the markings of a deliberate and pre-planned operation to purposely eliminate witnesses to the criminal malfeasance of ranking U.S. officials, unquote. Walk us through what that means in practical terms and its implications, Jeff.
Well, we don't know the full story of this pullout and what went on between the Afghan government, the militaries, what they knew on the ground, what the deal was with the Taliban. We don't know all the details. We only know what the U.S. government is telling us and what U.S. officials are claiming. But there's another side to the story. And some of the people that can tell the other side of this story, ones that are not bought off or corrupt, but merely in that middle-level position of knowing, let me put it this way, and there may be more coming on this, people who they could have gotten out, that they were forbidden to get out, who were our allies, who were blocked, intentionally blocked by the U.S. government from getting out, as if they wanted them to stay there and die.
Including providing the names of such people to the Taliban, which they did, to say nothing of, you know, keeping them outside of the gate and getting to the planes and being exfiltrated. He goes on to say, in the course of the 13 days that he and his folks were working on the ground, quote, we have again and again butted up against the inescapable conclusion that the U.S. government has no intention of preventing the annihilation of the witnesses, our allies, our Afghan friends. In fact, the Taliban's planned massacre may be part of a U.S. government cover-up, unquote. I mean, this is explosive stuff, Jeff. And I have to say, when we have the Biden administration trotting out in the person of the president, the person of the Secretary of Defense, and the person of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, this narrative that this has been an enormous success, covering up the evidence that it's been anything but, or trying at least to make less of it available. Some of it's just manifest, but some of the stuff that these witnesses might be able to attest to, were they to survive, could conceivably be a purpose of a government that is, I think, engaging in a big lie about Afghanistan. Could it not?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a very big lie about Afghanistan. And the question is, there's certain things about the Afghanistan story that we don't know the details of. And that is the relationships between our people, our generals, our officers, and some of the people on the ground in there. There was opium trafficking going on there. There was also betrayals of our ally in the fact of the way we conducted ourselves. Look, Mohammad Karzai, that's the guy, the president that we had in there for years after we initially arrived. Karzai was always warning about the Russians. In fact, he was thought to have a paranoid obsession about the Russians and that the Russians were involved in his government, that they had gotten in there, that partly the Russian interest was in the opium trafficking, and that the U.S. government, he complained, his defense minister, Mohammad Shaheen, for example, he claimed was a KGB-trained Russian operative. And there are other people that have made that claim about Fahim. Now, Fahim died in 2017, but I think it was of a heart attack. But this is an example of the kind of problems. And American officials would just kind of make faces, you know, oh, well, that's this Karzai. He's crazy. You know, he's crazy about the Russians. But you got to wonder about, you know, how many American generals or officials or intelligence people were compromised in that theater by Russian infiltration, let alone what the Chinese were doing in theater and what the involvement of the Chinese and Russians with the Taliban have been. We're hearing reports on the ground that the GRU was working with the Taliban.
That's Russian military intelligence. Yeah.
Right. And so, are we covering up then for what Russia and China have done against us there too?
Well, we know we've been seeing a lot of covering up about what the Pakistanis were up to. We were talking earlier in the program with Victoria Coates about it, they've been betraying us for sure and working with the Taliban, even though we were underwriting their, military and intelligence services for many, many years. Jeff, you mentioned China. Let me just turn to that directly. Ki Bono, who benefits, is a question that I also discussed a little bit with Victoria, but I'd like to get your thoughts on it too. You've been studying closely the Chinese and what they are up to. We have the spectacle of the newly appointed Chinese ambassador to the United States making his maiden speech, a classic wolf warrior diatribe against this country. I expect we're going to see a lot more of that from him and others out of China, especially in the aftermath of this humiliating strategic defeat of the United States in Afghanistan, don't you? But more to the point, talk about China and what you think is likely to emerge in terms of not only their position in Afghanistan and Central Asia more generally, but the degree to which they may be emboldened to finally go for it in Taiwan against us, perhaps elsewhere.
Well, what I find most disturbing about his statements, the Chinese ambassador's statements, are that, we have a really good reasons to cooperate on climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic. I think these are the two areas where we are in the greatest danger of China, because China is not going to have to abide by anything that climate change related. They're the biggest polluter in the world, and the United States is going to be asked to bear the burden, the cost of this, trying to change the temperature of the earth, basically, which is insane. And it's not going to work, and it's stupid. And there is no global warming. We're headed for global cooling. But the problem here is that then you get to the vaccine. And what do they mean by cooperation with the United States on the COVID? Does that mean medical cooperation where they become more involved in our pharmaceutical industry, where they become more bounded to our medical research? Yeah.
And does it mean that we wind up with health or vaccine passports akin to their social credit system, platforms that are used by them and would almost certainly be used by sort of the Marxists in this government, ours, to exercise control and essentially usher in more of a totalitarian system in our country as well?
Yeah, well, a common design between anytime you find that between the Chinese communist system and our system, you're talking about something that a KGB defector once referred to as convergence, where our system begins to converge with theirs. And this is where economic engagement becomes dangerous, because it was originally Kissinger and Nixon envisioned it the other way around. They become more capitalistic and they become free, but now it looks like with the pandemic, it's the other way around.
We've got John Kerry, the special envoy for Joe Biden, traipsing around Beijing. I think he's just concluded his trip over there. This is the man, and we're talking with Victoria about this, who perpetrated substantially this so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, with the Iranians, in the process absolutely selling out his country, not for the first time, but markedly in this instance. Is there any chance, do you think, that he might be trying to do the same with respect to the Chinese under the pretext of cooperation on climate change?
Well, climate change cooperation is selling out, because that China is not going to be required to do anything, and we are going to bear all the costs. So it's automatically Munich all over again versus China. It's an economic Munich. They would destroy our economy, because if you make our economy function with having to pay all these costs of lowering the climate temperature, which is impossible, they're just impositions on us. They're just massive costs. We would not be able to compete. Yeah, taxes, massive tax, crushing taxes.
And Jeff, then there's the further problem that if those the hard left, and we'll be talking more about this with Bill Walton in a moment, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her Green New Deal have their way, we will be buying all of these electric cars, or at least components for electric cars and the technology that goes into them, the rare earth minerals, lithium, and so on, from the Chinese. So we will be further bolstering their economy at the expense of ours, among other things.
Absolutely. That preventing our economy from being competitive when they have an economy that's already encumbered by being under a communist government, this is what allows them to compete. This is what allows them to overtake us in industry and after industry and area after area. Yes, absolutely.
Jeff, this is such important work that you do, and I really commend to people both your blog, jrnyquist.blog, as well as your writings at the Epoch Times and elsewhere. I want to thank you for today's insights in particular and sharing with us those of this intelligence operative as well. Next up, Bill Walton. We'll talk with him about what's make of the corporatists' collaboration with the radical left to help the Chinese Communist Party.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a delight always to say that we are joined by Bill Walton. He is the star of a terrific TV podcast called The Bill Walton Show. He is a former financier on Wall Street of great distinction, but now a man very much of the right, former president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member, and one of the conservative leaders of our time, and a man whose brain we welcome the chance to pick whenever we can. Bill Walton, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Frank, great to be here.
A lot to talk about with you, Bill. Let me start with a piece that was written by Politico this week, and as my friend Steve Bannon likes to say, it wasn't written by Steve Bannon, it wasn't written by Frank Gaffney, it wasn't written by Bill Walton, it was written by, one of the most highly regarded publications of the left. And it talked about the extent to which the Chinese Communist Party is now mobilizing its old friends, as they like to call their useful idiots, I think, the people they work with in your former neck of the woods, Wall Street, the people they work with in other C-suites across America's corporate, hierarchy, and the left, the hard left in the United States Congress, to try to protect China from legislation that increasingly enjoys broad bipartisan support aimed at, ending the practice of enriching, otherwise underwriting, and empowering our mortal enemy, namely the Chinese Communist Party. What do you make of all this, Bill?
Well, it's nothing new. The Chinese have been whispering in ears, or worse, corporate CEOs and other people who want to do business with China for decades now. And, this is just the latest round. I think the Chinese were surprised, as am I a little bit, that Biden has continued to be tough on China. And whether this is just rhetoric or he really means it, it certainly has a Chinese concern. And the Congress has been passing all sorts of bills to protect Americans from what China is doing. And one of the very interesting bills had a provision in it that would force companies to have their investments in China reviewed by some sort of commission to be formed, similar to CFIUS, which reviews in Chinese investments in the United States.
And that, of course, is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S.,
and,
right?
Now, I'm not a big fan of having a government agency review investments. My libertarian streak screams at things like that. But it is, if you think that China is a strategic long-term enemy, and it is, it makes an awful lot of sense to know what American companies are doing in China. And they don't want that.
Bill, you've learned a lot, I know, in the period since you left Wall Street about China. And one of the things I value so much about your contributions to this program is your perspective from that vantage point, but nonetheless informed by your close study of what the Chinese are up to and what it portends. And I guess the thing that was really striking to me is roughly at the same time that this Politico article was put out, George Soros of all people, was writing in the Financial Times what I would characterize as a pretty strong warning to American investors, particularly passive investors in big products, indexes like the MSCI, you know, All Country World Index, and in Larry Fink's various operations, a big promoter of investments in China. And Soros was basically saying, look, you don't really, in all likelihood, understand that what you're doing or what people are doing with your money, more to the point, is now putting you in real jeopardy because it's all subject to the whim of one man, Xi Jinping, who doesn't have your best interests in heart. Have I got that about right, first of all, in Soros? And this would seem to be a pretty strong countervailing signal to people he usually hangs with on the left not to do what these progressives, so-called progressives, are doing on Capitol Hill, no?
Boy, there's a lot to dig in here. I mean, that George Soros should be writing this in the Financial Times is really stunning, given that he's been aiding and abetting the progressives in the United States, and the progressives are making common cause with China. And BlackRock, which are offering these mutual funds investing in emerging markets, although BlackRock's now declared that China is no longer an emerging market, you're really investing in a huge portfolio of Chinese stocks, all of which, you know, Chinese companies, we know, are not exactly good governance entities, and their board of directors are controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, and the Chinese Communist Party is controlled by one man, Xi. And the hypocrisy of these funds, though, goes another step, and that Larry Fink talks about the investing in environmental, social, and good governance companies, and that's one of their criteria they preach to everyone who will listen. Well, there's not a Chinese company that qualifies in that regard, certainly not climate or environmental, certainly not social with what China is doing with its Uyghurs, and certainly not good governance, where you've got board of directors that are hardly diverse, unless you consider, you know, different type members of the Chinese Communist Party as diverse development. And we need to follow this closely to see where George Soros is going with this.
Yeah. Well, it remains to be seen whether this is evidence of the so-called broken clock syndrome, which is right twice a day, or whether it is evidence of a rethink.
Well, I had to check the byline.
Yeah.
wait a second. Maybe this is Ralph Soros.
Yeah, a distant cousin. But Bill, here's the question, I guess. Basically, is it possible, do you think, that some globalists, and there's no more archetypal one than George Soros, I think, with their visions of a reset, now beginning to have second thoughts about a partnership with the Chinese Communist Party? Is it too early to say that that's even true of Soros, let alone Klaus Schwab or anybody else at Davos? But doesn't it ultimately have to come down to that, whether they really think that the world ordered according to the Chinese Communist Party is going to be consistent with their vision of a sort of reset that puts them in charge?
Well, I think that may be the fear. You know, the global elites, Davos man and woman, have been making, you know, the social media companies, the big investment management companies, all the major corporations like Nike and Disney, and have all been making common cause with China for various self-interested reasons. And really leaving America first, you know, people like you and me who care about America and constitutional government and freedom, left in the dust. And they may be looking now at China saying, wait a second, Xi has changed China dramatically in the last decade. And it's now really looking an awful lot. We got the son of Mao, in charge, and he may not be our friend. And, you know, they're doing things, cracking down on companies in China, the technology companies, consumer companies, any of the companies that they see as you know, strategic. They basically put the private education industry out of business because they didn't want them teaching things that Xi didn't want taught. Now that sounds awfully familiar. So that's the other thing. It seems reckless about what BlackRock's doing in, with China, declaring that it's no longer an emerging market, it's a development market, and that people ought to up their allocation by three times to Chinese securities.
They're investors you're talking about. Yeah.
They're investors, yeah. But, you know, they manage $1 trillion and the Chinese market's about $15 trillion. So, you can see them wanting to play in the same sandbox.
And at what cost, I guess, is the question, because as we've discussed in recent weeks, Bill, well, freedom ultimately, yes. But even in the shorter term, American investors are losing hundreds of billions of dollars. As a result of this this misplaced investment strategy of Larry Fink's, and I just, at what point? I mean, Bill, you know that business. It's unforgiving. I think when people wind up losing large amounts of other people's money, it generally doesn't sit well with the people at the losing end. No. And do you see any correction in sight with Larry Fink, especially on the fraudulent character of what he's doing? It's not just that it's a bad investment, but he's also wrapping it up in, as are others, in fairness. George Soros, in his article, talks about the MSCI All Country World Index having as among their top constituents, two Chinese companies, Alibaba and Tencent, which are neither of them E, S, or G compliant, and BlackRock's own ESG-aware emerging market exchange-traded fund has a third of his investments in these Chinese companies. I mean, this just is stunning, I think, to the layperson saying, what on earth is going on here?
Would he say, welcome to the fast lane or something like that? I think investors tend to be, Jamie Dimon said, welcome to the fast lane, life in the fast lane. I think investors tend to think governments are going to be behave rationally and not destroy wealth. And the assumption has been that the Chinese would want to help Chinese companies grow and create wealth for the Chinese Communist Party and their aims. And Xi doesn't think like that. He's really thinking in terms of control, and he's willing to crush the market caps of some pretty significant companies. You know, Jack Ma, who founded Alibaba, he felt got out of line, and I think their market cap's down by almost half because of the crackdown. And
he was banished for a couple of months, it seems.
Yeah, well,
who knows under what circumstances, but he came back from it rather contrite, it seemed.
And so we've got a non-economic actor in Xi. He's got a much bigger agenda than just Chinese getting wealthy. And, what he's doing by allowing BlackRock to come in is he wants us so intertwined with China that we're not able to act against them. And they're welcoming U.S. companies then, as long as you play by the rules. Now,
their rules, whatever they may be.
Their rules.
Subject to change without notice. Yeah. This is really stunning.
Movies. They're not going to find anything in a movie made in Hollywood that would offend the Chinese, because they want that export market.
Bill, there's so much more to talk about on this financial side, but let me ask you to put your conservative movement leader hat on. Just going back to the progressives in Congress, and I really resent the term progressives because that sounds so benign. These are Marxists. Make no mistake about it, folks. They are pursuing revolutionary Marxist agendas in the United States Congress, in my judgment, and aiding and abetting the Chinese Communist Party in trying to stave off legislation that would, as they put it, prevent a new Cold War is really leaving us undefended, or less defended than we need to be, certainly, in what is not just a new Cold War. This is a people's war that the Chinese Communist Party has declared against us. And Bill, I just ask you, when you see the likes of Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the rest of them, essentially serving as the running dogs of the Chinese Communist Party, running interference dogs specifically. Doesn't this really scream out that we have an enemy within problem here that is aiding and abetting the enemy without to our great peril?
Well, yeah, our enemy within is our enemy within is all in terms of an enemy of freedom and what we believe in. Our enemy within is almost worse than our enemy without. I mean, Omar said that that we shouldn't be going after China as just Cold War mentality, and we're using China as a scapegoat for our own domestic problems, in other words. And, you know, Frank, you look at our defense establishment, the enemy within, I mean, you've got Mark Milley or General Milley, who said that he's concerned, more concerned about white rage than he is doing the right thing in Afghanistan. He didn't quite say it that way, but that's the way.
That's the way it worked out. Yes, indeed.
The military seems more concerned about domestic, what they call domestic terrorism, than they are with actual terrorists, people who want to kill us. And it's alarming. And we saw that. We saw that in this catastrophe that was the Afghanistan pullout, is that we've got most of the people in Washington don't think China's the problem. They don't think Russia's the problem. They don't think the Taliban the problem. They think that ordinary Americans, people who voted for Trump,
constitution-loving Trump voting, and,
yeah,
Americans.
Right. It's something we've got to be. I'm going to choose my metaphor. I was going to say up in arms, but that would get me into the January 6th crowd. It is a huge issue.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
And that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce would start making common cause with Omar on things like not being too tough on China is appalling.
It gives the term woke capital a whole new meaning and a very, very dangerous one at that. Bill, this is a subject to which we will return with you next week. Thank you for your time today and for your great expertise on all these subjects. Stay well. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Biden administration insists that its end to the Afghan war was an enormous success. To paraphrase Bill Clinton, that depends on what the definition of success is. Taking nothing away from the brave Americans who extracted some 120,000 people from the jaws of the Taliban's killing machine, whether the evacuation was a success will depend in part on whether that number includes jihadists who are being admitted without vetting into this country and maybe, perhaps literally, ticking time bombs. The fact that the Biden team is trying to gaslight us into believing a rout was actually a great accomplishment not only further undermines confidence in its leadership and agenda. This stunning misrepresentation also puts into sharp relief and discredits what actually constitute other big lies perpetrated by Mr. Biden and his political and media allies over the past year. This is Frank Gaffney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
The torpedo bomber he flew was hit by anti-aircraft fire while making a run over Bonin Island, 600 miles south of Japan. He headed out to sea and ejected from his burning plane this day, September 2nd, 1944, and was rescued by a submarine. Receiving the Distinguished Flying Cross, he graduated from Yale, became successful in the Texas oil industry, and entered politics, eventually becoming America's 41st president. His name, George Bush, who began his inaugural address, "My first act as president is a prayer. I ask you to bow your heads."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.